Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. I want to touch upon a few subjects today. First, I want to say a few words about intersectionality. This is a term that was first coined back in 1989 by a black feminist named Crenshaw. It essentially says that the various forms of oppression like homophobia, racism, sexism, so forth, all constitute an intersecting system of oppression. All the oppressed groups should be united against the power structure that's doing the oppressing. The truth be told, this doesn't make any sense to me because different groups are oppressed by other differing groups. They don't really have any relationship with each other. However, the bottom line is that the term is being used today to justify anti-Semitism. One of the ways that this is done is to define the oppressing group as the white people. And since the Jews are white, according to this theory created by a black person, the Jews are among the oppressors and not among the oppressed. If this sounds ridiculous, it is indeed ridiculous. But it is an excuse for black anti-Semitism, despite all the Jews that have done in the United States what they've done for the blacks. The other topic today is the civil war among the various Palestinian groups, the PLO, Hamas, and the other jihadist groups. They're busy killing each other in a real bloodletting war. I want to say a few words about that. And finally, I will say a few words about a new law that was recently passed in Belgium, which essentially prohibits kosher slaughter of animals. It is really the result of both a combination of anti-Semitism and the new anti-Muslimism because of all the new Muslims coming to Europe. And it's hiding behind and pretending to be a humane approach to animals. That is the newest threat to the Jews in Europe. And I'll say a few words about it. Thanks again for listening, Jay Shapiro. I shall be right back.
Always challenging the status quo. Hello, I'm Rod Bryant on Beyond the Matrix here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. I want to encourage you to listen each week, every Wednesday at the same time, for an amazing show that will challenge you, inform you, and inspire. News, views, and wisdom for the nations. Here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Don't forget, Beyond the Matrix every week, Wednesday, here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again. I want to say a few words about intersectionality and anti-Semitism. Intersectionality is a fairly new sociological term that sounds innocent. The term was coined back in 1989 by a feminist scholar named Crenshaw, who also happened to be black, and the term was used to describe how racial and gendered discrimination overlap, specifically for African-American women, but the application of the concept of intersectionality has been cunningly co-opted by the BDS movement, which is anti-Semitic. They claim to be anti-Israel, but they're actually anti-Semitic. Several years ago, for example, as a reaction to the election of Trump as president of the United States, a very local group of women organized a protest called the Women's March. That sounds innocent enough. And indeed, thousands of women almost entirely from the political left, joined ranks and marched through the streets of Washington and also other cities around the United States. And this is a protest against Trump. I remember it happened during his inauguration also. Now, this year, the third annual Women's March was scheduled to be held in 2 weeks from now. However, over the weekend, it was canceled. The organizers explained the cancellation by saying the march was becoming too white. A march for women was not interested in the participation of white women, especially in the partition of white women who happened to be Jewish. Although it was not the reason for the cancellation formally given, the march has been really filled with anti-Semitism. The American press has been covering the Women's March for a couple months now. The New York Times, which I may say something more about them in a further segment this week, the New York Times ran a front page story describing the anti-Semitic character of the Women's March in an article entitled Women's March Roiled by Accusations of Anti-Semitism. Now, how did this happen? How could a march organized by those on the political left, primarily black women, which essentially, what are the black women? They're a minority group clamoring for equality. And they're critical of bias. Now, how could it turn its back on another minority, the Jews, and hurl criticism at the Jews? One would think that participants and organizers of the Women's March would join hand in hand in condemning something which has really been bad around for years and is known to be bad. That's anti-Semitism. However, they were the people responsible for spewing forth and perpetuating anti-Semitic bias in the context of women's rights, strange as it may sound. Their thinking is convoluted and wrong. It's because it makes no sense. It goes like this. This is how they see it. Because the majority of Jews are white, they are viewed as white oppressors. Now, a woman named Pogrebin, who's the founder of Miss Magazine, and who is Jewish and who's a feminist, she confirmed the attitude in a letter to the New York Times. In her letter, she pointed out that anti-Semitism in the liberal movement is not new. 40 years ago, she wrote, she confronted the exact same anti-Semitism. When it comes to anti-Semitism and leftist movements, there's no logic involved. It's been happening. We saw it in the period at the time of Zionism. In other words, what's happening today on the left, the political left, is quite similar to what happened 100 years ago on the political left. Now, what happened was the socialist and communist movements began 100 and some years ago, and they were ideal things for the Jews in Europe to join. Jews were an oppressed minority, and by definition, socialism and communism offered protection from oppressors. Jews were not welcomed into any of those movements, not the socialist movement, not the communist movement. From the very beginning, they were simply not welcome. The tension was extremely positive in the end for the future of Jews and Jewish socialism. I'll explain that in a moment. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, who were the founders, if you will, of communism, partnered together with another philosopher by the name of Moses Hess. You can check him out on the internet. I'm going to be speaking about him in a meeting in a couple of weeks. Moses Hess was the third member of this group. It was Marx, Engels, and Hess. You don't hear much about him anymore. He was a member of the inner circle. He fathered actually labor Zionism and socialist Zionist philosophy. He was forced out of the movement by Marx. Movements founded on the principle of unity against racism and hatred have always essentially had one caveat. Everyone is equal, everyone but the Jews. At that time, I'm talking the turn of the previous century, the socialist movement was heavily based in Germany, and the literature is in the German language. but it was only the elite who wrote and spoke in German. The masses were not in Germany, and Jews were part of the rank-and-file population. Those Jews spoke Yiddish, and those Jews were not welcome in these movements. As a result, two Jewish socialist groups emerged independent of the major movements. One was composed of Jewish socialists and was called the Bund, meaning the band or the group, and the other was called Zionist Socialism. Now, Jewish socialists embraced Yiddish as a language and as a socialist message. And when I lived in the United States, we had a next-door neighbor who was a Bundist. They belonged to what was called the Arbeiterring, the workman's circle, and they opened schools and newspapers and radio stations. Even in America, they had these Schulen, their schools. The ideology that began in Europe was transplanted to America because a lot of these people from Eastern Europe who were Bundist or socialist, they moved to America. Now, socialist Zionists, on the other hand, felt that the best response was excising Jews from Europe, bringing them to Israel, or at that time it was called Palestine, and then they would establish a socialist utopia. These were the socialists who essentially founded and created the modern state of Israel. They came with all their biases, and they tried to build a socialist state. They did not speak Yiddish anymore. Among themselves, perhaps, they did. But on the other hand, Hebrew became the new language. And many of these groups, even after the foundation of the State of Israel, many of these groups continued to support the Soviet Union, even when the Soviet Union turned against the State of Israel, and they found that they had divided loyalties because they saw the Soviet Union as the ultimate success of socialism. Now, we know how that came about. So the Bundists, who went to the States primarily, or else they were wiped out in the Holocaust in Europe, and the socialist Zionists who came to Palestine had the same goal. They were trying to solve problems. The biggest problem among them was the problem of anti-Semitism. So it's interesting if you look at how history works. Had the Jews been welcomed and accepted into the original communist and socialist movements, much of the impetus to create a state for the Jews would have been diluted, because these Jews who came to settle and struggled really hard at the turn of the last century, you know, to create kibbutzim and things of that nature, had the communist and socialist movements not been anti-Semitic, they would have merged into those movements, and the end either would have gone to the United States, or they would have been wiped out in the Holocaust had they stayed in Europe. So had the Jews been welcomed into those movements, much of the impetus to create a state for the Jews would have been diluted. They would have exercised their political feelings in Europe or in the United States. And my grandfather, who came to the United States at the beginning of the 20th century, told me how strong the Bund was in the United States. And in even my generation, there were Bundists, and there were people who consisted on speaking Yiddish all the time and having their kids go to these socialist schools. The movements, some of the original youth movements here in Eretz Yisrael, in Palestine, were socialist movements. They created, for example, the kibbutzim. So as for achieving the goal of solving the problem of anti-Semitism, it looks like we're still fighting that battle. It's interesting. Those who created the Bund and the socialist Zionists essentially didn't fight anti-Semitism. In a sense, they walked away from it. They said, if the anti-Semites won't have us, then we'll do our own thing in keeping our own ideology, which was socialism. But now we have back again, 100 and some years later, the Women's March of 2019 has been canceled because it's struggling within itself to fight its own, or maybe it's losing the battle already, to fight its own anti-Semitism. And that is a very sad thing. Intersectionality should be what we call in Yiddish parva, neither dairy nor meat. It turns out that it sounds good, but it turns out that it's anti-Semitic. I'll be back after the break. Jay Shapiro here.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I'm Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. We are now being told that there's no date set for the highly touted and long-awaited Trump peace plan to be made public. And there's a good reason for this. Many say they would like to see Israel and the Palestinians return to the negotiating table. They want the Israelis and the Palestinians to resume the so-called peace process, which as far as anybody who understands is concerned is moribund. But they're hoping that Israel and the Palestinians will manage to reach a historic agreement that would end the Israeli-Arab conflict and bring real peace to the Middle East. Now, that's very interesting. There's a lot of bloodletting going on within the Palestinian area. The biggest losers from this bloodletting are the Palestinians living under these groups, either in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank or Hamas, which rules Gaza. The dispute, interestingly enough, between Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank is not over who will bring democracy and better economy to the Palestinians. They're not fighting over who will improve the living conditions of the Palestinians by building new schools and hospitals. They're not fighting over who will introduce major reforms to the Palestinian government and end financial and administrative corruption. They're not fighting over the need for freedom of expression or a free media. Mahmoud Abbas and the Hamas leaders correctly argue that the Abbas is not a legitimate president. If Abbas were to sign a deal with Israel, people could come along later and say that he, Abbas, lacked the legal authority to do so, and they would be right. In order for any peace process to move forward, the Palestinians first need to stop attacking each other. Then they need to come up with a new leadership who actually cares about the Palestinian people. Recent days and weeks have witnessed the two groups, Hamas and essentially the PLO, maligning each other beyond anything previously seen. Fatah and Hamas have reached a new level of mutual loathing. And at times it even seems, and I think it's quite true, that Fatah and Hamas hate each other more than they hate Israel, which is really saying a lot. They're busy killing each other, by the way. This area, the Middle East, particularly here where we are, doesn't need a peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. It needs a peace process that the Middle East is crying out for, and that is a peace between Palestinians and Palestinians, a peace that would end their bloody internecine war. Before pushing peace upon Israel and the Palestinians, it would be helpful if the international community first tried to help the Palestinians stop fighting each other. The Palestinians cannot make peace with Israel while they're busy killing their own people. The Palestinians cannot make peace with Israel when their leaders lead only themselves, and the leaders are leading themselves to money and power. The political struggle between the PLO, Fatah, and Hamas is not a normal dispute between two rival parties in parliament. Rather, it is a rivalry between two large groups and two governments that have tens of thousands of armed men at their disposal, and they have massive arsenals of weapons. The biggest losers from this internal bloodletting are the Palestinians, whether they live under the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank or whether they live under Hamas in Gaza. They're the losers. Fatah, the largest faction of the PLO, is the dominant party that controls the Palestinian Authority, and they have tens of thousands of policemen and security officers in the West Bank who are funded and trained by various Western countries, including the United States and the United Kingdom. Similarly, Hamas in the Gaza Strip has thousands of security officers and militiamen who help them maintain a tight grip on the Gaza Strip. Back in 2007, 2 years after the Israel withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, Hamas violently kicked out the Palestinian Authority regime in Gaza. Since then, Hamas has been the unchallenged ruler of the Gaza Strip, where 2 million Palestinians live, in that very narrow strip of land. It took Hamas less than a week to remove Abbas's government from power and seize control violently of the entire coastal territory. So the dispute in the bottom line is not between Hamas and Fatah. It's not over who will bring democracy and a better economy to the Palestinians. You have to make this clear. They're not fighting over who will improve the living conditions in the West Bank or in Gaza. They're not fighting over the need for freedom of expression and a free media. Instead, this is simply a struggle over money, power, and also ego. The Palestinian Authority and its president, Mahmoud Abbas, are furious with Hamas because it forced them out of the Gaza Strip violently 11 years ago. Abbas and his senior aides and advisors have yet to overcome the humiliation they suffered when Hamas militiamen overthrew their regime and killed a number of Palestinian Authority and Fatah men. Abbas is now trying to shame his rivals in Hamas. He seemed to want Hamas to pay a steep price for expelling him and his regime from the Gaza Strip 11 years ago. Abbas is apparently disturbed because Hamas defeated his loyalists back in 2006. Also, not only did they kill him, but they actually had a parliamentary election and Hamas won the election. The result of that vote was humiliating for Abbas and his regime. And by the way, he's in the 11th year of his 4-year term. Last year, in the context of his unsuccessful effort to undermine Hamas, he imposed a series of moves that included the suspension of salaries of thousands of civil servants living in Gaza. Abbas also stopped paying Israel for the fuel and electricity it had been supplying to the residents of the Gaza Strip. So that Israel has kept supplying the electricity, but it's running up a tremendous bill. But these measures backfired, which have further undermined Abbas's credibility among his own people. He's now being told by many Palestinians that he's responsible for their suffering, the misery of his own people in the Gaza Strip. He's being accused of imposing a blockade on his own people, of being an Israeli collaborator for conducting security coordination with the Israeli security forces in the West Bank. Hamas leaders may also be planning for bringing Abbas to trial on charges of high treason. a crime which is punishable by death according to Palestinian laws and also their traditions. Now, Hamas says that Abbas is a dictator, which he is. He refuses to share power with anyone, and he has very close relations with Israel, according to Hamas. Hamas leaders never failed to broadcast that Abbas's four-year term in office expired in 2009. They argue that he's not a legitimate president. If Hamas is condemning Abbas for his decision to dissolve the Palestinian parliament. Anyhow, all this proves, according to Hamas, that Abbas is an autocrat and a dictator who presides over an authoritarian regime, which is true. They also claim he's a traitor because his security forces cooperate with Israel. Meanwhile, Abbas, for his part, has made similar charges against Hamas. This goes back and forth. Hamas, in the meantime, complains that the former president of Afghanistan, who came to power to help the U.S. and Western countries, is similar to Abbas because he gets American money. Therefore, Abbas is a puppet in the hands of Israel and the United States. So hundreds of the PO loyalists were jailed in the Gaza Strip by Hamas. And so Abbas has repeatedly accused Hamas of being in collusion with the U.S. and Israel to create a separate Palestinian state in the Gaza Strip. According to Abbas and his representatives, U.S. President Donald Trump's administration and Israel are working to establish a small and isolated Palestinian state in Gaza, thus permanently detaching it from the West Bank. Now, what's happening is that there's absolutely no love lost between the leadership of Hamas and Fatah, and they distrust each other. And in order for any peace process to move forward, the Palestinians first need to stop attacking each other. Then if they come up with new leaders who actually really care about their people, these are the conditions that have to be met, but they're rather unrealistic at this point. Any talk about the resumption of an Israeli-Palestinian peace process sounds like nothing so much as a big joke. So now you can understand why Trump is not bringing out his peace plan. First you have peace between Hamas and the PLO. Then you can start thinking about peace with Israel. This does not seem to be realistic for the foreseeable future. I'll be back after the break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa, and each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany's but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi again, you're back with Jay Shapiro. A law went into effect last week in Belgium, in the northern part of Belgium, which I think is a result of the large influx of Muslims into Europe, but it's going to affect the Jews as a side effect. The law went into effect in Flanders, which is now banning kosher slaughter, shechita. A similar law will go into effect in the southern region in September. Thus, the entire country of Belgium will essentially prohibit Jewish kosher slaughtering. The law states that animals must be stunned before slaughter, and the Jewish law stipulates that meat can only be kosher if the animal was healthy and awake before being slaughtered, and stunning constitutes an injury rendering the meat no longer kosher. The law, in effect, and this is what's happening, it bans slaughter according to Islamic law, as well as the Hindu and Sikh methods of meat production. Antwerp in Flanders is the home of Europe's largest Orthodox Jewish community, which will now have to import its meat from countries that have not banned shechita. Neighboring France, home to Europe's largest Jewish population, will likely experience a boom in its kosher business. Antwerp's Jewish community is still recovering from the Holocaust area devastation. Since its establishment in 1966, there's a place in Antwerp called the Kosher Poultry Factory. It's owned by a non-Jew, but it grew together with the local Jewish community, which numbered only a few thousand people after the Nazis murdered most of Jews in Flanders. By the end of last year, the factory, as I said, owned by a non-Jew, was processing 80,000 chickens a month. And this gives an idea how the region's Jewish population has more than quadrupled since 1945. It's about 20,000 people now. But all that ended when a law banning methods used in kosher slaughter went into effect. The business had to close the 10 employees and close up shop. The hundreds of meat professionals, this means an attack on tradition and entire industry. Now, it has less immediate implications for Antwerp's Jews, who can simply switch to importing customs-free kosher meat from elsewhere within the European Union. Yet many of them view the law both as a declaration that the Jews are not wanted in Belgium and as the opening shot of further hostile action. On the ground, it makes little difference. They still have meat. The problem is the message it sends. It tells Jews, we don't want you here. This ban is a prelude, possibly, to a ban on importing kosher meat, and it might even bring new restrictions like meal on circumcision or other elements of Jewish life. As I said, the new law requires all animals to be stunned before they're slaughtered. Now, Jewish leaders fear the same political forces, which is a number of animal and child welfare activists, together with anti-immigration groups. They'll try to move to ban ritual circumcision, which is performed both by Jews and Muslims. The law in Flanders came after a 2014 public debate about the slaughter of animals by Muslims. Now, the Muslims are doing their slaughtering in unregulated slaughterhouses, which means they also have a health problem. In Western Europe recently, animal welfare and child welfare activists have found unlikely allies in individuals and politicians critical of the impact of mass immigration to Europe by Muslims. In other words, this attack on kosher slaughtering and the killing the way Muslims do it is really an attack on the Muslim influx. The Jewish customs, which are pretty similar to Muslim ones, they've been ignored or tolerated for decades, and they become collateral damage to this alliance of these people. This law was written supposedly on the basis of humane treatment of animals, but is a generous dose of anti-Muslim sentiment, and that's helped it get into the law books. The government in Belgium recently fell apart as a result of a dispute over its refugee policy, so issues related to minorities are a hot topic in Brussels and in Antwerp. Brussels, of course, the capital. As often happens when xenophobia spreads on the continent, even when it's not originally meant to target Jews, somehow the Jews end up suffering the consequences. That's historically true. Now, There's a long tradition of European anti-Semites using animal rights to ban kosher slaughter. Right after coming into office in 1933, one of the first things that Hitler did was to ban kosher slaughter. Today in Switzerland, which uses a system of referendums to decide on individual policies, the first such vote was on banning shchita, which was prohibited federally in 1893. Norway banned slaughter without stunning in 1929. Sweden followed in 1937. As of course I said, one of the first things Nazi Germany did, which spread, of course, to its allies, Italy and Hungary. And finally, these laws, after the war, of course, these laws were overturned. Today's ban on kosher slaughtering is being imposed despite the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights. They have a convention. The official name is the European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms. And what does this do? It guarantees the right to freedom to manifest religion or belief in worship, teaching, practice, and observance, which shall be subject only to such limitations as are necessary in a democratic society in the interest of public safety, for the protection of public order, health, or morals, or the protection of rights and freedoms of others. That's the wording of this law. Now, on the face of it, there seems to be a contradiction between the guarantee of human rights and fundamental freedoms in Europe, according to this law, rule, and the new ban on kosher slaughtering. It's a contradiction. In fact, the only way to understand the current situation, that in banning shchita and banning kosher slaughter, these European Union states are saying it's reasonable interpretation of the law to consider protecting the age-old traditions and religious rights of Jews, Muslims, and other minorities. To them, protection of these religious rights have become a lower national priority. These states claim to be taking a moral stand when, in fact, all they've done is the exact opposite, the immoral and undemocratic act of violating their citizens' basic freedom of conscience. That's a very interesting thing. As I said at the outset, this may be a development coming from the reaction of the influx of Muslims into Europe. The Muslims also slaughter without stunning, and therefore this is an attack on the Muslims, and a side effect, an ancillary effect, is it affects Jews. Now, so far, as I said before, the Jews can import from other countries. But as long as we're talking about the European Union as a unit, this problem could spread. Right now in Belgium, the kosher slaughter ban is only in Flanders, which is the Flemish region. Antwerp is the capital there. And that's one of the three states that make up the federal kingdom. Another region called Wallonia will impose a ban in September. Austria and Estonia also enforce strict supervision of the custom, so it makes Jewish life very difficult. Right now, no country in Europe currently forbids non-medical circumcision of boys, but Europe is seeing a domino effect where Jewish customs are collateral damage to the what people are not happy about, the influx of Muslims. So what happens is, what do you do? You can look into Jewish law and find a little sideways around it, but anybody who's Orthodox now, or not even Orthodox, somebody who wants to eat really kosher food or basically kosher food, is going to have difficulty in Belgium, and this will probably spread to other countries in the European Union. There is no doubt that this ban will go far beyond the local Jewish communities. As I said, there are other countries that have banned it already, but the question is this the beginning of I can't remember the exact word, but one thing starts rolling into the other. Antwerp is home to Europe's largest Orthodox community, and to ban slaughter there is an attack, really an attack on the community. As I said, they'll have to import their meat from countries that haven't banned shchita. So I don't know what's going to be, but this is absolutely not a good sign for the future of Jews in Europe. And as I said, one of Hitler's first laws when he came into power in 1933 was to ban kosher slaughtering. So it's interesting, the banning of kosher slaughter made the what they call the canary in the coal mine. Years ago, canaries are more sensitive to noxious fumes in the air than coal miners are. So years ago, the coal miners used to carry canaries into the mine with them, and if something happened to the canary, if it got sick or died, the coal miners knew to get out of there because the air would soon be bad for them. So the banning of shchita might be the canary in the coal mine as far as the Jewish communities in Europe are concerned. I don't want to be pessimistic, but there are historical precedents to this kind of thing, and I hope it really won't happen here. So until next time, thanks for listening. This is Dave Shapiro.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com homepage, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candle lighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.